Good evening, everyone. Please go ahead and get a Bible out and turn it over to Judges chapter 2. Judges chapter 2 is where we'll start in our sermon here in just a moment. I want to reciprocate what Jeff said. It's been fun seeing him grow up, too. I'm joking, of course. I say that because I want to cry when I look out at this audience. There's so many of you who saw me grow up, not just Jeff, in the last 8 years. Harrisburg was my first work out of a training program, and there's many special people who came tonight. So thank you for being here. It's great to be back in the Northeast. You know, the summoning and the gathering of God's people and addressing them is one of the oldest traditions that God's people has. And that's one of the beautiful things about the Northeast. A gospel meeting isn't just a tradition, it's an opportunity. And people come from hours away at times because this is the nearest congregation aside from their own. They'll drive hours just to hear somebody stand up and say, "Thus says the Lord." But that's a tradition that has been going on for a long time. You think about, for instance, Moses gathering the people and saying, "I have a message from the Lord," at the bottom of Mount Sinai. It's time to listen up. I think about Samuel, who, when he gathered the people, began to warn them in 1 Samuel 8 of what it would look like if they really got a king. I think about Ezra during his time frame, where he stood up with all of the people and he began to read from the law of the Lord. And the people, it said, listened intently from daybreak until noon. And finally, I think about our Lord Jesus, who went on top of a mountain, gathered his people to himself, and said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." You think about Jesus seeing those people as sheep without a shepherd, teaching them many things. And you know, we think about that gathering of God's people, and we realize what weight it carries when one person stands up and says, "This is what God wants you to do." And among those countless speeches in the Bible, where it's Moses or Ezra or Jesus or whoever, you know, there's one thing that would grab people's attention. And I would suggest to you, there's something that a speaker can say that grabs your attention today as well. And that's when a teacher says, "I have a story I want to tell you." You ever been listening to a dry sermon? I'm kidding. Have you ever been listening to a dry sermon and the speaker has kind of been moaning on and on? And he says, "I have a story I want to tell." And there's something about that that just makes you lean in a little closer and go, wait a second, what did I miss? Because there was a reason that led up to him wanting to tell a story in the first place. And there's different kinds of stories that a speaker might tell. There might be something he says to his audience about his own life. Maybe he uses allegory. Maybe he even makes up some kind of parable or fable. But what he's trying to do is illustrate his thesis and connect his audience to whatever the case it is that he's made. And in our lesson tonight, we're going to see a man tell a story that captivates the attention of his audience. We're going to examine that story. And there's even a story within that story. And the Old Testament loves to tell those. That's why Paul said in Romans 15 that whatever was written in the past was written for our instruction so that we may have hope through endurance and through the encouragement from the scriptures. You know, I remember learning this and then having to look it up later in life in English class, the six phases of storytelling. Justin, you know about this, right? There's other language arts people in here who excelled. But there's six basic phases. If you want to write a good short story, some of you kids have learned this, you're going to have some kind of setting or exposition where you set it up. There's going to be some kind of conflict and rising action, which ultimately comes to a climax. And after the climax, the action falls and there's some sort of resolution or conclusion to the story. And I would suggest to you that in our text tonight, we see all six of these elements. And so I want us to begin in the setting. In this story, a few things you should know about this time period. If you're new to the Bible, if you're a first-time visitor tonight, we're glad you're here.
I'll set it up for you pretty simply. The people of God, Israel, are dwelling in the land and its allotted portions. And leadership in these days is not described well. Twice in Judges, we're told that in those days there was no king in Israel, but everyone did what was right in his own eyes. In other words, everyone just did whatever they wanted. They weren't concerned with what a king said because there was none. They were concerned with what they wanted. Can you imagine living in a land like this? Maybe we don't have to imagine for too long what it's like to live in a land like this, that everybody just kind of does what they want and they don't care about the higher authorities. But the book of Judges further explains to us what it was like to live in this time in chapter 2. If you're ever looking for a good mold of what is going on in the book of Judges, Judges 2, 14 through 19 is helpful. It describes for us what we call the Judges cycle. And if you're looking there in Judges chapter 2 and verse 14, it starts off by telling us that in these days, the Lord's anger burned against Israel, and he handed them over to the martyrs who raided them, and he sold them to the enemies around them, and they could no longer resist their enemies. And whenever the Israelites went out, the Lord was against them and brought disaster on them, just as he had promised and sworn to them, so they suffered greatly. And so the Lord raised up judges who saved them from the power of their martyrs. But listen to verse 17. But they did not listen to their judges. Instead, they prostituted themselves with other gods, bowing down to them, and they quickly turned from the way of their ancestors who had walked in the obedience to the Lord's command. They did not do as their ancestors did. He's pointing out that this generation is different from the one before them. This generation didn't care about the Lord. They didn't fear him. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. In verse 19, it'll say, whenever the judge would die, the Israelites would act even more corruptly than their ancestors, following other gods to serve them and bow and worship. They did not turn from their evil practices or their obstinate ways. Israel abandoned God. This happens 12 times in the book of Judges, this cycle that we're talking about. And each time and they get back around to repenting, God will raise up another judge. And it just happens over and over and over again. And there's a good story that helps us see just how off the rails Israel got at this point. Every good story first begins with some main characters. I want to remind you, before we get into it, about a few of ours. There's this man named Gideon that we're not going to get to spend a lot of time talking about tonight. We're going to be talking about his son. But Gideon was the one, you might remember, who delivered the Israelites from the Midianite oppression. God had assembled an army of 32,000 people, and God had him whittle it down to just 300 men because, of course, God was concerned that even with just 300 men, once God gave them the victory, they would still take the credit for themselves. Gideon, at the end of his reign, we're told in verse 22, the Israelites came to Gideon and said, "Rule over us, you as well as your sons and your grandsons, for you delivered us from the power of Midian." And listen to what Gideon said. In verse 23 of chapter 8, Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." Seemingly, Gideon looked really solid. He refused to be the king. Wouldn't that be tempting for us? Look at everything I just did for Israel. They want to make me king? That sounds great. He says no. But in verse 24, then he said to them, "Let me make a request of you. Everyone give me an earring from his plunder." Now the enemy had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they said, "We agree to give them." So they spread out a cloak, and everyone threw an earring from his plunder on it. And the weight of the gold earrings he requested was 43 pounds of gold, in addition to the crescent ornaments and ear pendants, the purple garments on the kings of Midian, and the chains on the necks of their camels. Gideon made an ephod from all this and put it in Ophrah, his hometown. And all Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there. And it became a snare to Gideon and his household. Sometimes actions speak louder than words. Here he is saying, "Don't worship me, don't make me king." And then he turns around and he makes something like this. And to make matters worse, you look down at verse 30. Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, since he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son. And he named him Abimelech. And then Gideon, son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of his father, Joash. Okay, Gideon, you seem to be a good dude at first. You've not said, or you've said, I'm not going to be your king, then you did this unfortunate thing with this gold. But do you know what the name Abimelech means? It means my father is king. Again, our lips are sometimes really good at saying one thing, but our actions reflect what we really wanted all along. Have you ever wondered what naming a child this does to someone's psyche? My father is king. My father is king. We learn that in our next piece of the story, what it does to a kid's psyche when they believe this. We get ultimately to what is our conflict in chapter 9. Now, our conflict begins with this Abimelech, my father is king. He ends up going back home. In chapter 9 and verse 1, the text says, Abimelech, son of Jerubbabel, went to Shechem and spoke to his uncles and to his mother's whole clan, saying, please speak in the hearing of all the citizens of Shechem. Is it better for you that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbabel, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Remember, I am your own flesh and blood. Abimelech gets back to his hometown in Shechem, and he immediately starts politicking. And did you notice what he's trying to do here? It's actually kind of wise. He doesn't go into the town and to all the men and starts trying to talk to them. No, he goes to these relatives of his, and he starts on them. Let me convince them that it wouldn't be good for the rest of these sons to be the ruler. Shouldn't it be somebody like me, one of your own flesh and blood? What he's doing here is very evident. He's trying to exalt himself. And you just think about how wise he does it. In verse 3, after he's made the appeal to his relatives, it says his mother's relatives spoke all these words about him in the hearing of all the citizens of Shechem. They were favorable to Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. So they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the temple of Baal-Berith. Abimelech used it to hire worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. And he went to his father's house in Ophrah and killed his 70 brothers, the sons of Jerubbabel, on top of a large stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbabel, survived because he hid. And all the citizens of Shechem and of Beth Milo gathered together and proceeded to make Abimelech king at the Oak of the Pillar in Shechem. Okay, if we're keeping up with our characters, we're introduced to a few more people here. The first one is the men of Shechem. Now remember, these are Abimelech's relatives. I don't know how close he was with them, but he seems to act like they had been close at some point. But there's another character that we were introduced to, because once he hires these worthless men after taking up the collection, it says he goes out and he kills all of his brothers, but there's this one brother that gets away, and his name is Jotham. If you like reading short stories, we ought to be captivated at this point. You have murder, you have insurrection, you have all of these different elements happening. And he goes, he kills all of them. Jotham, in some dramatic fashion, is able to get away. And if you're Jotham, what would you do? I would run and not look back. I'm out of here. This is not my problem. I'm so thankful I was able to escape. I am gone. I am out of here. But what we actually learn about this guy? That he's a quick student. He sees exactly what's going on with Abimelech. And here in the midst of conflict, Jotham really puts himself out there, because he does something that I talked about at the beginning of the sermon. He gathers the people and he tells them a story. Tells them a fable. Let's read this together. It's fascinating what Jotham has to say to them. In verse 7, just follow along with me, Judges 9, verse 7. When they told Jotham, he climbed to the top of Mount Gerizim, raised his voice and called to them, listen to me, citizens of Shechem, and may God listen to you. The trees decided to anoint a king over themselves. They said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, should I stop giving my oil that people use to honor both God and men and rule over the trees? Then the tree said to the fig tree, come and reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, should I stop giving my sweetness and my good fruit and rule over trees? Later, the tree said to the grapevine, come and reign over us. But the grapevine said to them, should I stop giving my wine that cheers both God and man and rule over trees? Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, come and reign over us. The bramble said to the trees, if you really are anointing me as king over you, come and find refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon.
We'll stop there for now.
Do you watch the way that Jotham challenges the people? He does exactly what we said earlier. Just tells a simple story. Some initial observations about this parable. Number one, I think it's captivating. I mean, he uses these inanimate objects, this personification, to just kind of grab your attention. Number two, there's no question that the olive tree and the fig tree and the grapevine would have been great leaders, but in the text, they understand their roles. This is not what they foresee themselves doing. And then there's the irony of the bramble, a last resort pick for them. They go over to the bramble and say, just come reign over us. And he's got a couple of conditions for them. Bramble often does. If you make me your king, come and find refuge in my shade. What a hilarious thing to hear Bramble say. If you've ever been hunting and walking through the woods, Bramble is not a place you would sit down at to get some shade from the sun. I mean, for starters, it's kind of big and prickly, so it's going to hurt you if you try to do that. But secondly, it doesn't really produce shade. It's just kind of a big ball of thorns. It doesn't do anything for you. But he says, just come here. I'll give you some shade. And then the second thing he says is a threat. If not, if you don't choose me, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Whoa. Ultimately, he's just going to be fuel for a fire? What is your point, Jotham? Maybe they felt somewhat like Jesus' disciples did at times. What's the point of this parable? Just like the parable in the sower, Jotham tells him what the point of this is. In verse 19, he says, if you've acted faithfully and honestly in making Abimelech king, or in verse 16, and if you've done well by Jerubbabel and his family, if you have rewarded him appropriately for what he did, down in verse 19, if you have acted faithfully and honestly with Jerubbabel and his house this day, rejoice in Abimelech, and may he also rejoice in you. But if not, may fire come from Abimelech and consume the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo. And may fire come from the citizens of Shechem and Beth Milo and consume Abimelech. And Jotham fled, escaping to Beer, and lived there because of his brother Abimelech. If you did this honestly, best of luck to you. But Jotham knows better than that. You all didn't. You had to kill all of his brothers to make this happen. That's what it was like to be in the days of the judges. And what we go on to see in the rest of our story tonight is this very parable that Jotham told. It happens in real time. It's really cool to read. This is where we get to in our story, rising action. In verse 22, we're told it's been 3 years that Abimelech is ruling over Israel. And very clearly, in verse 23, God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem, and they treated Abimelech deceitfully. Now, there would be two ways that God is going to continue to capitalize on this when he sends this evil spirit between the people. The first one is in verse 25. It says that the citizens of Shechem rebelled, and then they go out to the tops of the mountains, and they're robbing anybody who comes by. And so they're just wreaking chaos and havoc among the people. But there's a second reason God lets this happen. In verse 26, the second way that God allows this to go downhill, it's this guy named Gaal. Gaal, in verse 26, is the son of Ebed. And he comes down with his brothers and crossed into Shechem, and the citizens of Shechem trusted him. And in verse 27, they went out to the countryside and harvested grapes from the vineyards. They trampled the grapes and had a celebration. Can you imagine what this was like? This random guy to us comes into the city of Shechem. They go out, they trample, they make this wine, they start drinking, and it's a drunken fest. It's a drunken party. And the text goes on to tell us that this man, Gaal, in a drunken stupor, I would imagine, says, who is Abimelech that he should be ruling over you all? He says down in verse 28, isn't he the son of Jerubbabel? Isn't Zebul his officer? You are to serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. Why should we serve Abimelech? If only these people were in my power, I would remove Abimelech. So he said to Abimelech, gather your army and come out. And that's when we're introduced to another character, and that is this Zebul. Zebul heard about this. Gale, I would imagine, not realizing he might have been in the room. And that doesn't sit well with Zebul. Who is this outsider coming into our city acting like he's going to cause some kind of insurrection? Who is this foreigner? And so to no surprise in verse 30, when Zebul hears about this, he gets angry and he sends word off to Abimelech. And he says to him in verse 31, "Beware, Gaal, son of Ebed, and his brothers have come to Shechem and are turning the city against you." And so the solution in verse 34, Abimelech and all the troops with him got up at night and waited in ambush for Shechem in four units. We'll get the jump on him. If Gaal wants a fight, Abimelech says, "We'll come at night. We'll be ready to pounce." Perhaps my favorite part of the story takes place next. Because in verse 35, Gaal wakes up from what I would imagine would be a hangover. And he goes and he stands in the entrance of the city gate. And Abimelech and the troops who were with him got up from their ambush. And when Gaal saw the troops, he said to Zebul, "Look, troops are coming down from the mountaintops." But Zebul said to him, "The shadows of the mountains look men to you. Look like men to you. Hey, don't worry about that. Those are just the shadows of the mountain." And again, imagine Gaal still being a little bit drunk. "Oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, yeah, that must be what it is." And Gaal speaks up again in verse 37. "No, look, troops are coming down from the central part of the land. One unit is coming from the direction of the diviner's oak." And Zebul replied, "What have you to say now, you who said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him?' Aren't these the troops you despise? Now go and fight them." What a moment for Gaal. "Okay, I guess this is what I said last night." I don't know if he really knew what he said. "But here it is. Here they are. Abimelech is here. Go out and fight them." And so Gaal just kind of goes, and he goes out and he starts fighting. He takes the citizens of Shechem with him. They fight against Abimelech, but it does not go in his favor. In verse 40, it says, "Numerous bodies are strewn as far as the entrance of the city gate. And Abimelech stayed in Arumah. Zebul drove Gaal and his brothers from Shechem, but Abimelech was not through with these relatives of his." Because Abimelech went out and camped. And the next day, the people of Shechem, the ones who were left over, they went out of the city. When Abimelech saw that, it says he came out, rose against them, and struck them down. And where there were some units, who it says in verse 44, gathered and rushed forward to take their stand at the entrance of the city gate, while two of the units went out to the countryside, and they just slaughtered anybody who was out there. In verse 45, Abimelech fought against the city that entire day, captured it, and killed the people who were in it. And he tore down the city and sowed it with salt. Did this part of the story sound familiar to you, by the way? Abimelech turning on Shechem. Didn't it sound just like the parable of the bramble? Where Jotham said, "If you make the bramble the leader, it's not going to end well for you." Let's see if it ties in any more. In verse 46, when all the citizens of the Tower of Shechem heard, they entered the inner chamber of the temple of El-Berith. And it was reported to Abimelech that the citizens of the Tower of Shechem had gathered. So Abimelech and all the troops who were with him went up to Mount Zalmon. And Abimelech took his axe in his hand and cut a branch from the trees. He picked up the branch, put it on his shoulder, said to the troops who were with him, "Hurry and do what you've seen me do." And each of the troops also cut his own branch and followed Abimelech. And they put the branches against the inner chamber and set it on fire. And about 1,000 men and women died, including all the men of the Tower of Shechem. Wow, that sounds awfully familiar. It sounds like the bramble when he said, "If not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon." The men of Shechem turned on the bramble, and the bramble spit fire back out. And this, of course, brings us to the climax. Things look pretty good for Abimelech at this point. Boy, he has squashed that, hasn't he? I mean, he has just leveled Shechem. Anyone who turns on him, they better watch their back. And so I don't know if Abimelech got a little cocky and a little bit arrogant and just wanted to go out there and make everybody know that he's the boss. So he says in verse 50 that Abimelech went to Thebes and he was planning to do the same thing there. He camped against it and he captured it. And there was a strong tower inside the city and all the men and women and citizens, they fled there and they locked themselves in and went up to the roof of the tower. Pretty solid plan, you would think. But just from what we read Abimelech did, He knows the play to do here. Last time a bunch of people locked themselves in a tower, all we had to do is just go cut down these branches, throw them against it, boom. And so down in verse 51, it says, or verse 52, Abimelech came to attack the tower. He approached its entrance to set it on fire. He's really going to take this. He's going to take Thebes 11 miles northeast of Shechem. Why not just copy and paste? It worked there. It's going to work here. But once there's a climax, there's a falling action. And in verse 53, a woman threw the upper portion of a millstone on Abimelech's head and fractured his skull. So there's literally falling action there, by the way. And he quickly called his armor bearer and said to him, draw your sword and kill me, or they'll say about me, a woman killed him. So his armor bearer ran through him and he died. When the Israelites saw that Abimelech was dead, they all went home. What was his reasoning for not wanting this woman, or not wanting to die this way? I don't want everybody to know that a woman killed me. And yet, here the Bible still says for us, this story still tells us, it was really this woman who killed him. This woman of Thebes, I believe, belongs in this story. Plays an integral part to it. And so there's a resolution at the end of this. In verse 56, in the same way God brought back Abimelech's evil and the evil that Abimelech had done to his father when he killed his 70 brothers, and in verse 57, God also brought back to the men of Shechem all their evil, so the curse of Jotham, son of Jerubbabel, came upon them. God takes care of everyone in this story. If you're looking for who the real hero in the story is, it's the Lord. It's God. He's the one who took care of things exactly the way they needed to be handled. What's the point of all this? What's the applications? What are the lessons? It's a cool story. This is where storytelling and preaching are different from the world. Because I didn't get up here and you didn't drive all this way to just hear a cool story and walk out. We're here to learn. I want to share a few things that I've learned just thinking about this story. You know what Jesus said in Luke 14? Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself will be exalted. What we have in this story is this age-old lesson being played out before us. If I want to seize something that is not rightfully mine, this will inevitably be my downfall. Now, the application I'm not up here to make tonight is that you shouldn't run for political office. I don't think you should, by the way. Like, maybe not the greatest use of time all the time. However, what I do think it's important for us to think about are the different ways we try to exalt ourselves on a regular basis. Let me suggest a few ways where we might be tempted most to do that. Am I the person that's always having to one-up in a conversation? Just get someone under my thumb. Someone tells a story or they say something and whatever I come up with, my brain is going to say it in a better way or tell a better story just so that they know and they understand, hey, I'm just a little bit better than you always. That's exalting ourselves. In Romans 12 and verse 3, Paul made it very clear that the grace that is given to me, I tell everyone among you not to think of himself more highly than he should think. Instead, think sensibly, as God has distributed a measure of faith to each one. Perhaps I'm taking a seat of authority over somebody because I esteem myself more highly than I should. And often when I think of myself as better than others, there's all kinds of other sins that end up working their way into my life. Lying and manipulation is one of them. Because I'm trying to talk myself up in a way that it alters their perception of who I am. But I want to talk about another important way, because here's a reality I know just from being in the Northeast, and that is a lot of our congregations don't have elders. They don't have shepherds. That's something I still pray for regularly, even though I'm in Indiana where there are elders. I pray for these Northeast congregations all the time. Because that was kind of a big wake-up call for me when I went from a congregation that didn't have elders to one that did. It's good to have elders. It's a blessing. That's something a congregation needs. But when a congregation doesn't have elders, there's a real temptation for Bramble to get in. I don't know how your congregation conducts things whenever there aren't elders. Maybe it's men's meetings. That's been my general experience. But perhaps a question each of the men need to be asking themselves, if that describes you, and I know it does many of you, is how do I react whenever my opinion isn't heard? Like, you are in the men's meeting or whatever you call it, and you go to say something, and everyone just kind of shoots it down. What's going on inside of your heart? Is it a, I got to find a better way to say this. I got to start going around, and I got to start talking to people in their homes so that they understand where I'm coming from. Or is it possible that maybe what you said was just a bad idea? And that maybe your brothers that you love and trust didn't see the wisdom that you thought was there? Maybe you should humble yourself. How do I react when others disagree with me? Because if I continue to exalt myself in those kind of situations, what is God going to do? God's going to humble me. That's what this text, that's what this story tells. Don't exalt yourself. Now, another question I thought about for myself from this text is, have I settled for Bramble as my leader? I want you to think back to Jotham's parable for just a moment tonight. The trees were super desperate for a leader, and they settled for Bramble. That's often when people start to settle for Bramble, is when they're desperate for a leader. Is it possible for me to do that? Let me give you three areas of our lives where it's possible. Number one, who is my personal leader? Like, what am I letting be the thing that dictates my day every day? Is it pride? Is it money? Is it lust? Is it greed? Is there other things that I let creep in and become my leader? Why is it those things often, like pride and greed and lust? It's because those things are easy. They want to be the leader. Those sinful things want to be in control. They're the Bramble saying, I'll do it, I'll do it, I'll do it. I just recently watched both of the Inside Out movies with my girls. I think there are some wonderful applications from it if you've seen them. If you're not familiar with this movie, it kind of shows you what's going on inside of someone's brain, inside of someone's head. And it's a cartoon that Disney made where there's this little girl and she has all these different emotions that are trying to get in the driver's seat and are trying to be the leader at the control board of her brain. And you've got anger and disgust and joy and sadness and all of these others. Is that not a helpful way to think about who our leader is? Who's in our brain trying to direct me? What do I let be my leader? If we put sins and emotions in the driver's seat, it'll be to our peril. Now I want to go back to talking about local churches for a second on this note. Because just like in our story today, it is still true that oftentimes the more prideful people will push themselves forward to be leaders. And we are seeking more men to step up and serve. I've never said that in a church and someone come up to me and said, no, actually, we're good here. Never had that happen. Every congregation is looking for more men. We need more men to step up and serve. More men who can serve as elders. More men who can teach and preach and just be the godly men they need to be. But each man who's desiring to step up in some way, there's a question you need to ask. Am I a bramble tree? What's my motivation? How different would this story have been if the olive tree or the grapevine or the fig tree had actually stepped up? But the reason they didn't is very telling of the judges' time period. Maybe they didn't have an olive tree. Maybe they didn't have the fig tree or the grapevine. And when you have no one, that's when Bramble starts raising his hand, saying, I can do it. It's me. I can come in there and I can do a great job. And so you know what that tells us, church? We need to start raising up godly young men who are ready to step in that role. And especially for the congregations up here. We've got all kinds of good young men. I helped out at Soul Camp for years. Last year was my last year. We've got good, godly young men. You need to be thinking about it now. Serving as elders in your local congregations. Be the kind of young men who aren't the bramble, but are like the grapevine, the olive, or the fig tree. I think we need to think about what kind of leader we are at home. Husbands and fathers, listen up. Am I the kind of husband or father who hurts others because of my selfish choices? Or am I the kind of leader who humbles myself and uses what I have to just serve others, like the other three possibilities in the parable? My last point for tonight is to let God lead. Men will do everything they can do to push themselves forward, to be your leader. But ultimately, it needs to be God. We need to remember that. Because when you turn on the news, there's a lot of people who want to try and convince you that they're running things, that they're ultimately in charge of your life and in charge of your wallet and in charge of all these other issues. None of them are. In our story, I want you to think about just how fickle and easily swayed the people of Shechem were. First, they go over here and they band with Shechem, and then in a moment's notice, they're willing to go over here and they're able to band with Gale. But in the end, what did God do to Shechem? What did God do to Abimelech? And what did God do to their temple, to their false god? He destroyed them all. So who do I want to serve at the end of the story? Who do I want to be my leader? Because if it is anyone but God, I have settled for Bramble. And it will be to my peril. Fire will come out. It will not end well. Fire will come out and consume me. Do I need to make God my leader? I don't know what that means for you. I recognize a lot of faces out here who are Christians. Maybe there's some in here who aren't. Where I'm at, we offer up an invitation, so I'm going to do that here, if that's okay. This is a good opportunity for us all to think about who our leader has been. And the beautiful thing about this being a congregation of God's people is if I've misprioritized that, and I'm letting sin or something else rule me, this is a good place to ask for prayers from your congregation, from your brothers and sisters, and get accountable so you make sure God is your leader. Maybe you're not a Christian. Maybe you've been having some Bible studies with some of the folks here, and you're ready to make God your leader. We encourage you to really think about that. Maybe that means you're ready to be baptized tonight. Maybe it's not. Whatever it is, go talk to someone tonight so that you can be ready. If you have any spiritual need and we can help address that, you can come down to the front as we stand and sing to give you some encouragement.